It's the holidays. Time to think about politics?
You stick a gun to somebody's head and say, give me $20 to feed this guy that's dying of starvation on the street right now, or I'll kill you. Have you done something charitable? No, you've committed a crime.
Navigating political disagreements at the holiday table, plus remembering Santa and listening to the Northern Lights. I'm Susan Barnett, and it's a special holiday edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective. This is the time of year when people all over the world aren't just buying gifts and planning holiday menus. They're trying to help their neighbors. But for one community in Manchester, New Hampshire, private acts of charity aren't just a holiday tradition. They are a display of libertarian, even anarchist, principles. Emily Corwin reports.
50 people are gathered in a converted office space with $6,000 worth of food and a list of needy families. Boxes of cabbages and oranges are piled high.
There are eggs around here somewhere.
Mike Ruff is a 40-year-old mediator and blacksmith who helped organize the event. He's filling shopping bags with food for the hungry, with help from a couple kids.
And a thing of chili powder.
Ruff has an M1911 pistol strapped to his waist. Why? He says he doesn't trust tax-funded policemen to protect him, and for the same reasons, he doesn't trust the government to help the needy. Ruff is a member of New Hampshire's growing Free State movement, which means he moved from somewhere else to New Hampshire for the state's low tax burden, its live-for-your-die mentality, and to agitate for smaller government. He's not the only person here who thinks this kind of private charity should replace all tax-funded social services.
We all agree that privately funded voluntary charity is superior to the welfare system.
That's Amanda Bolden, the event's coordinator. Bolden looks, well, tired and also humbled by the $6,000 that was donated to buy food.
So there's African, Bhutanese, chicken or turkey.
Bolden is making sure her volunteers get suitable meals to needy refugees and diabetics.
Chicken diabetic, turkey diabetic, and Burmese.
Like Mike Ruff, Bolden moved to New Hampshire to join the Free State Project. She says she doesn't blame anyone who uses food stamps or public housing, and she knows her $6,000 is just a drop in the bucket when it comes to ending hunger. But she says forcing the public to pay taxes to solve social problems is immoral.
If you stick a gun to somebody's head and say, give me $20 to feed this guy that's dying of starvation on the street right now, or I'll kill you. Have you done something charitable? No, you've committed a crime.
Not everybody here sees taxation in such strict terms. Mirav Yaakov is an Israeli who recently moved her family from Colorado to New Hampshire to join the Free State Project. She's here volunteering with her daughter Maya. Yaakov says she's not comfortable in big organizations.
There's research out there that says people function best in groups of 150, and I would like to organize my life in these kind of terms.
Yaakov says big organizations like government just don't work for her.
I don't know who runs them. I don't know what their interest. I can't subscribe. It's hard for me to be part of big things like this that I don't have personal contact with.
Yaakov says the freedom-loving people at this event are some of the most creative people she's ever met, and the strength of their relationships is striking. 24-year-old Caitlin Appel moved a year ago with her fiancé Elizabeth to join the Free State Project. Appel says they didn't expect to make so many friends so fast.
But then it was like this whole wider community that we didn't know, and over this whole year we've just been completely like embraced by them. It's kind of amazing.
Appel is not the only one. Almost everyone at the event moved to New Hampshire in the last 3 years, many in the last 6 months. In that short time, they'll tell you emphatically they've come to love each other and their community, perhaps even more than they dislike taxes. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Emily Corwin.
Here in the U.S., the political divide often seems as vast as the Grand Canyon, particularly when you're sitting across the table from a family member. Commentator Chris Tucker finds himself wondering about the personal price we pay for our political opinions.
It's no secret that America changed after September 11, 2001. The major issues that now dominate our political landscape, border security, surveillance, interrogation techniques, barely registered before that day. It's a confusing time that's left many of us uncertain as to the best course to follow in this dangerous new world. The red state, blue state split is only one crude measure of a division that goes much deeper. And for many of us, these conflicts seem all the more unfortunate during the holidays, that time of togetherness and harmony when, as the old song says, those who are dear to us draw near to us once more. This year, I find myself thinking of the people I've become estranged from as we took different political roads over the past few years. My relationships with at least three relatives and a handful of friends have suffered because of these disagreements. I'll still see some of them over the holidays, but I can't say I'm looking forward to it as I once did, and they probably feel the same way. Because of post-9/11 politics, the war, and what someone called the war over the war, we've lost the easy familiarity that comes of shared opinions and beliefs. At one time, we knew, without having to prove it, that certain policies were inherently good and right, even if they didn't always work. We knew certain politicians were simply ridiculous, even if they happened to be president. Now those unspoken agreements have vanished. Hurtful words have been exchanged along with gifts. We now avoid certain topics and usually tiptoe around the minefield of politics. This has come as a sad surprise to me, though perhaps it shouldn't have. In college, I studied the McCarthy era and the bitter feuds over communism that divided former friends and associates. But I never quite understood how people could spend decades arguing over Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers and which one was telling the truth. Now, alas, I get it. 50 years ago, they had Who Lost China and those 57 or 205 communists infesting the State Department. We have Mission Accomplished, Slam Dunk, Guantanamo, and other loaded phrases that will haunt many a future holiday. I suppose the hardcore true believer in a movement or cause doesn't mind losing friends over it. If they can't see the light, he may think, let them go. But even if we could be sure that the politicians we support would really accomplish the goals they espouse, which we can't, of course, we should be very slow to put ideology over friendship. That's why E.M. Forster, in his great essay, What I Believe, said that if he were forced to choose between betraying his friend and betraying his country, he hoped he would have the guts to betray his country. How strange that politicians most of us will never meet, unless we live in Iowa, and policies that may baffle the brightest historians should pull us apart from those we know and love. How sad that friendship should be based, even partly, on political conformity. It's enough, almost, to make you envy the apathetic.
And here's a different take on the spirit of giving from commentator Margaret Agard. A fire truck in the driveway, 20 at the table for meals, and buying by the dozen, the better for sharing. Agard's father believed in being Santa Claus all year round.
Santa Claus was my father. Every year, my father donned his Santa Claus outfit and headed out. First, he visited the small children in our home. Next, he went to the neighbors. And finally, he delivered cookies and gifts my mother had made to widows and shut-ins. One year, a woman called the house saying she heard the knock, saw the gifts, and then saw Santa Claus disappearing around the back of her house. For a minute, she almost believed. That accomplished, my father came home and started the turkey with his famous oyster dressing. He never went to bed before 4 a.m. on Christmas Eve and was always up early Christmas Day with his camera or video camera on. He was on a kind of Christmas high at Christmas. But he didn't stop at Christmas. He didn't wear the suit, but he was still Santa Claus. He bought things by the dozen, they're cheaper that way, and then gave half away. Hair dryers, electric shavers, he shared everything, even his home. We always had extra people living in our house, usually troubled teenagers, since he had a special rapport with them. When I was 18 and went off to college, he bought an old farmhouse on 40 acres in New Jersey and moved the family out to farm country. He wanted a place for my 5 younger brothers, who were becoming teenagers, to have a place to run and to work hard. He put an old construction trailer on part of the site and put an extra family in there, turned a small shed into a charming 2-room cottage, and put an older couple in there, and still stuck a couple of extra teenagers in the house. So much for my sister's hope for a bedroom to herself. We often set the table for 20 for meals. There were always friends visiting or workmen working on part of the house as he renovated it. It was the same way everywhere we were. For years, we spent our summers in Nova Scotia. He'd buy 2 to 3 dozen lobsters at a time, build a huge fire outside, and use this monster cauldron to cook them. Then invite the neighbors over for a feast. I thought that was how everyone ate lobster. The first time I saw the price of lobster in a restaurant, and then found out they only served the tail, which I didn't even think was the best part, I was stunned. While my dad was cooking lobster, my mother was doing all the rest of the meal, organizing the children to set the table, clean the house, and be polite. We used benches at our table so we could always squeeze in one more person. Back in New Jersey, he turned part of the 40 acres into a baseball field complete with steel-fenced backstop and then let the town leagues use it. He liked to buy fireworks and shoot them off, huge, commercial-sized ones. The town said he could if he let them park a fire truck there. So he bought a used fire truck and invited the town to the fireworks. True, we had a fire truck in our driveway for years. He gave little children rides in it just for the joy of it. He and my mother served together. They made a good team. He and my mother would be out driving together when he'd say, "Well, let's stop in and see so-and-so." Invariably, so-and-so was in some kind of need. Once they walked in on a single mother with five children. She had half a box of crackers in her cupboard and a small jar of peanut butter to feed all those children, which included one 13-year-old very hungry boy. They brought her bags of groceries, offered her a part-time job with my father's business, and helped her enroll in school so she could learn some skills. People said he always just seemed to show up when they needed help. He just liked to give. He loved people in life. He was one of those work hard, then play hard people. My grandmother said he wasn't always like that. He contracted Lou Gehrig's disease when he was 32 and expected to die a slow, ugly death. The elders placed their hands on his head and promised him he would live to raise his children. There were five of us then, eventually 11 in all, and the disease stopped. He still had it, but it stopped progressing. Because of that disease, he lived with the thought of death daily. He began to live life to the fullest, to do everything he thought to do immediately, because for him, there might not be a tomorrow to do it. He lost the use of part of his hands and still had quite a bit of pain, but that didn't stop him from serving, though. Then, when he was 48, he developed a particularly virulent form of leukemia. At the time, the survival rate was about 5%. Most adults contracting this died within 6 months. Everyone who went to the clinic with my father did die. Since he'd made friends of them all, this was a hard time for him. Once again, he was blessed that he would live to raise his children. My youngest sister was 3 at the time. The cancer went into remission. He lived, but the fight cost him his business and his home. Still, he had a Santa Claus suit, and he'd always liked to travel anyway. He worked in Alaska, Idaho Falls, Boise, and Cincinnati, making friends everywhere. He organized lunchtime cribbage tournaments and had lobsters flown in from Maine. When my youngest sister turned 18, both the cancer and the Lou Gehrig's disease returned. He retired to the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. That last Christmas, we gathered as a family, but instead of being Santa Claus and making oyster dressing, my father went into the hospital. Christmas night, my mom was leaving to have a visit with him. When I found her in the kitchen packing up cookies and cakes and filling a stocking, I said, "What are you doing? I thought you were going to go see Dad." She said, "I am. Your dad called and said his roommate has had nothing for Christmas. No visitors, no calls, no gifts. Your dad asked me to bring him some things." Even as he was dying, my father was being Santa Claus. Thank you, Dad, for teaching me the joy of finding myself by losing myself in the service of others.
Coming up, listening to the Northern Lights. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1223. Sometimes it's the little things that help us feel like we belong in the world. Jasmine Gonzalez of Curie Youth Radio in Chicago explains why one cup of coffee made her day.
My mom parks in the Dunkin' Donuts lot on 55th and Pulaski. She told me to get her medium coffee, extra cream, no sugar. I recite, medium coffee, extra cream, no sugar, a few times just to get it right.
Medium, extra cream, medium, no extra sugar. Cream, no medium sugar.
I come here almost every other day, so I'm not going to forget it.
147.
There are about 25 people pegged in the little steamy store, like children in line for free samples at a candy convention. So many people crunched up on the muddy carpet, waiting their turn for their morning fix.
1 million.
The guy in front, he reeks of cigarette smoke. Yuck. The toasting bagels make my stomach tighten. You, from behind the counter, smile at me. The first thing I see is your golden nose ring. I like it. You ask, can I help you? I smile, about to recite the order, when you say, wait, I know. Medium coffee, extra cream, no sugar. You got it right. Out of all the people you take orders from every day, you remembered my order. I walk through the snowy parking lot, get into the car, and gave my mom her medium extra cream, no sugar. Dunkin' Donuts lady, thank you. You may not know it, but you made me feel like I was remembered. Driving off the lot, I look out of the snow-crusted window and raise my medium extra cream, no sugar, to you.
That was produced by Jasmine Gonzalez of Curie Youth Radio, a writing and radio production workshop at Curie High School in Chicago. We're heading into the dark season, the cold season, the season when the night sky looks like a cold lake sprinkled with crystals. It's captured perfectly in the poem Winter Stars by Sarah Teasdale. I went out at night alone. The young blood flowing beyond the sea seemed to have drenched my spirit's wings. I bore my sorrow heavily. But when I lifted up my head from shadows shaken on the snow, I saw Orion in the east burn steadily as long ago. From windows in my father's house, dreaming my dreams on winter nights, I watched Orion as a girl above another city's lights. Years go, dreams go, and youth goes too. The world's heart breaks beneath its wars. All things are changed, save in the east, the faithful beauty of the stars. And if you are lucky enough to be in the right place, you may see a light show dance across the night sky. Have you ever heard the sound of the northern lights? It's the sound of the Earth's magnetic field and a perfect reminder of how small we all are in the vastness of space. Natural radio recordist Steve McGreevy was in Canada last year for the Northern Lights. Producer Barrett Golding has more.
There's just a whole litany of different natural radio sounds to record. Hisslers and growlers and howlers and tweaks, these clusters like a pack of dogs barking. And in the case of this morning, we're having these very soft, hissy whistlers, which are actually fairly rare. There was a burst of static from something pretty close, a lightning storm. Oftentimes when I'm recording, you'll hear kind of a and maybe a second or two later you'll hear the electromagnetic pulse from the lightning bolt takes a round trip to the opposite hemisphere, and then it bounces back. And in making this long trip, the frequency components are spread out, so you get this downward falling tone, like a sigh or a hiss. These receivers are sensitive enough that a lightning storm could be happening 1,000 miles away and the static would still be strong. You can just hear all the snapping. Let me turn on this speaker amplifier. You just can imagine there is so much. Oh, in fact, we're hearing some nice noises now coming in. Okay, this is a very beautiful sounding event. This is called chorus. Particles from the sun are hitting Earth's magnetic field and generating these noises, probably several thousand miles out in space. Imagine a soap bubble with wind currents pushing against it, and you can see it deform. Well, that's essentially what happens with Earth's magnetic field. So yeah, I've got these funky-looking triangular-shaped loops. Five turns of about 350 feet of wire hanging up on the tree, picking up the beautiful sounds of Mother Earth. There's vibrations of electrical and magnetic energy. And so essentially all these receivers do is pick up the Earth's radio waves and translate them directly to the same sound frequencies. And so the result is just beautiful and amazing. And it's been going on, well, for eons. And I first noticed it in England in about 1882. The British telegraph operators started hearing these strange whistling tones in their headphones. But it wasn't until the 1930s when some people started associating these with visible northern lights. As electronic equipment became more available to the average experimenter and hobbyist, amateurs started listening to this, using fairly crude equipment, you know, maybe a phonograph amplifier connected to a barbed wire fence in the middle of nowhere, and similar to what I did when I first heard this myself. When I discovered Earth makes its own radio waves, I was amazed because I'm a nature enthusiast anyway, you know, always been interested in astronomy and science. I've got a long, quite checkered history with radio, beginning as a little kid playing with an AM pocket radio and tuning in distant stations at night, and I've done all sorts of crazy things, planting radio beacons in the middle of the deserts and bouncing signals off aircraft. And I was a pirate radio operator for 8 years. One Sunday evening, I got a knock on the door about 10:30 at night. The fellow said, "Hi, I'm from the FCC. May I see your station?" Just about as cheerful as can be. There's a station in Colorado called WWV, which does nothing but transmit the time 24 hours a day on shortwave.
All the terrestrial indices for 21 June follow. Solar flux 102 and bold A index 16. Repeat solar flux.
But once an hour, WWV gives lets me know what's going on with the Earth's magnetic field, and they give what they call space weather, which is what's going on in the sun and between the sun and the Earth.
Solar activity was low. The geomagnetic field was quiet to minor storm. The forecast
so
for the next 24 hours.
I'm aware that right now the Earth is in a magnetic storm, and it may be affecting power lines right now. It may be affecting satellites right now. Space weather, this invisible weather we can't really see or feel on Earth, but indeed it's going on out there. And it's wild, and it's stormy at times, and it's calm at other times. It's just like weather here on Earth. Boy, at this very moment I've got my headphones on. These whistlers are really coming in big streams now. There's just one whistler kind of merging into the other, all slowly descending in pitch. Oh, these are so great. Wow.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us, and best wishes for a very happy holiday season and a wonderful new year from all of us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.